Welcome to Willoughby Hills. I'm Heath Rosala. Thank you for being here. This is my podcast. Glad you're here. Let's chat. Richard Rothstein is my guest today. Richard's a historian. He's an author. He's got two books that both touch on similar issues, and we're going to talk about both of them today. His first book in this space is called The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And then he has a new book out that he co-wrote with his daughter, Leah Rothstein. It's called Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation and Act It Under the Color of Law. So this notion has been a theme of this podcast lately, I feel like. This idea of racism, segregation, how it plays into our culture, how it plays into our built environment, every piece of that. And this notion, too, that certainly for white Americans, but really for a lot of Americans and kind of our collective cultural history, a lot of this history, a lot of these events have been purposely concealed from us. They're not taught in schools. They're not something that we talk about, but it's stuff that is right there and that if you just start scratching the surface, you can uncover. So the similar conversations, I talked to Richard Frischman and B. Brian Foster a few weeks ago about their book, Ghosts of Segregation, American Racism Hidden in Plain Sight. Hidden, but right there in plain sight. This also came up with Syra Rao, who wrote the book White Women, Everything You Already Know About Your Own Racism and How to Do Better. Again, everything that you already know. So Richard is hitting at this same idea, right? That our country is segregated. I think if you look around most major cities, you're going to find that even today in 2024. Certainly here in the Boston area, we feel those effects of segregation. It's not just a Southern thing. It was all across the country. But the argument that Richard makes in The Color of Law is that it was not happenstance. It was not, you know, economic opportunities or people that like to live near each other in the same race or whatever. The actual reason that we are such a segregated nation was because of policies at every level of our government that made it so. And we're only talking about laws explicitly kind of post-Reconstruction and really within the 20th century. Like there were a lot of places, and we'll talk about this today, that were fairly integrated at different points in our history that then became quite segregated. So this history is there, but it's not talked about. And, you know, what I love about Richard's work is that he's pulling all these different pieces together and saying, you look at economic issues, you look at criminal justice issues, you look at environmental issues, education issues, transportation access, like whatever issue is your focus. The reason that we have problems, the reason that we have disparities in these spaces goes back to policies of our federal government, of our state, and our local governments that deliberately separated Black and white Americans in the early 20th century and certainly through the mid-20th century as well. So that's the book, The Color of Law. We are going to get into that. If you haven't read that, please go do. It is a great work. It is it's stuff that every American should know. And I think it's one of those things that when you hear it, you go, oh, yeah, of course that makes sense. But wow, how have I not connected these pieces before? So Richard connects those dots. He brings it all together and makes it digestible and fairly obvious and undeniable. But at least for me, I was left reading The Color of Law saying, okay, what do I do now? And that's where this new book, Just Action, comes in. And again, this was co-written with Richard's daughter, Leah Rothstein, who works in the affordable housing space and is really more on the activist side. Richard comes at it from more of a historical perspective. Leah is more, okay, what do we actually do about it? But yeah, that's what Just Action is about. It's how to figure out, what do we do now? We know the history. We've learned the history. Richard has laid that history out in The Color of Law. What do we actually do? We're presented with this. We can choose to ignore it. We can choose to go back to our regular life and say, okay, that was history. That happened. That was somebody else's problem. Or we can say, okay, that happened. What am I going to do about it? What is my role in dismantling that, in undoing that, in making it better? So that is this new book, Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation and Act It Under the Color of Law. We're going to talk about that book today as well. It is a great read. I recommend read The Color of Law, then go read Just Action. Both of them are great works. And again, it's like exactly where I think I'm finding my voice now as a podcaster, as a newsletter writer. There are these issues that kind of keep getting pulled at from all these different angles. And, you know, like I thought when I started kind of getting more activist-y, I guess, when I started speaking out more and saying, okay, I don't like what's around me, it was coming from an environmental standpoint primarily. And as I sort of unpacked the layers of that, I realized you can't talk about environmental issues without talking about racism. You can't talk about economic issues. You can't talk about anything in this country without getting to the most basic place, the foundation that all of our country is built on, which is racism. And that sucks. And that's not what we learn in school, but that's there. Like, once you see that, you can't unsee it, and you got to do something about it. So Richard is one of those people doing something about it. I really appreciate his work. I want you to go read his books, and I want you to enjoy this conversation today. And before we get to it, I want to remind you, I have a newsletter that I publish every Sunday and every Wednesday. Go to heathrasala.com/newsletter. You can get on the list there to get those delivered directly to your inbox. You will also get alerted to every new podcast episode. And there's an and. If you appreciate the work that I do here, if you are learning something, if this conversation today sparks something in you, or if this is a continuation of several things you've learned, and you feel like, you know what, I am getting something out of Willoughby Hills, I am learning something, I am seeing the world differently, please consider upgrading to a paying membership. It really helps keep the lights on at this place, so to speak. You know, helps me with all the costs of this podcast and newsletter. HeathRasala.com/newsletter. Of course, free memberships are awesome as well. But if you have the means and you feel like you are really a heavy user of this podcast, the newsletter, and are learning things from it, please consider giving some additional support. I'd really appreciate it. With that, let's get to the interview. Here it is, my conversation with Richard Rothstein. I was kind of struck in reading both of your books. I've been reading them both over the last couple of days here. When people talk about social or racial justice issues, they often think of economic disparities, educational disparities, things like that. You get at a much deeper issue that kind of affects all of that, which I don't think people even realize is a thing, and that's zoning. Like, it's just kind of background noise for a lot of people. But sort of your central argument is zoning and sort of all the ways that we use our neighborhoods and our houses really affect everything else related to racial and social justice, right? Can you explain some of that? And is that a fair summation, I guess, of your work?
Well, I would frame it a little bit differently. Zoning is certainly one small part of the total picture.
Okay.
The theme of our work, my work and the work that I'm now doing with my daughter, Leah, is that the federal government in particular, and state and local governments as well, in the 20th century, enacted a series of unconstitutional and unlawful policies that were designed to segregate neighborhoods so that African Americans and whites could not live near one another in any metropolitan area of the country.
Yeah.
The purpose of the Color of Law book was to demolish the myth of de facto segregation.
Yep.
The idea that the reason that we're so segregated is because of private discrimination or people wanting to live with each other of the same race or economic differences. And what I demonstrated in that work is that that was a total myth. There was no basis in reality to it whatsoever. The reason we're so segregated is because of requirements on the part of the federal government and state and local governments that blacks and whites could not live near one another.
Yeah.
Now, the racial segregation that they created with those policies that were so powerful, and I can explain why they were so powerful, that they still determine the racial inequality today, underlies all of the things that you were just mentioning.
Yeah.
Educational disparities, health disparities, income disparities. It's all stems from the concentration of African Americans in single neighborhoods in the 20th century where they had no access to jobs that were any good, no access to well-resourced schools, no access to good health care, and where they did not have the opportunity to gain the wealth that came from home ownership that white Americans were subsidized by the federal government to gain, while African Americans were prohibited from participating in those programs. So zoning, of course, is one of the ways that those inequalities are perpetuated. But there are many, many ways in which it's perpetuated, and zoning is one of them.
Yeah, I mean, it's true. It's redlining and it's mortgage approvals. All of that kind of plays into that. When you talk about it happening in the 20th century, I mean, we're talking about it starting 100, 120 years ago and coming up through present day, or feeling the effects of it through present day. That's very recent history. I mean, that's like my grandparents can remember that. Why is it that none of us know this history, or how has it managed to have become so thoroughly buried in our kind of collective memory, or at least white America's collective memory?
Well, it's Black America's collective memory as well. The myth of de facto segregation is widespread across racial lines. African Americans aren't taught this history in school any more than whites are. And it's even more recent than you just described. The federal government in particular was not involved in housing prior to the New Deal, prior to the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration. There were local policies that imposed segregation, required segregation, also unconstitutional under the 14th Amendment and under the Civil Rights Act of 1866, which was still valid law. But the federal government didn't get involved in housing until the New Deal. It really intensified even later than that in the post-World War II period, when the federal government embarked on a program to move all of the white families who were living in urban areas into single-family homes in all white suburbs from which African Americans would be purposely excluded. Now, this was a federal program, intentional, racially explicit. The best known example of this is probably Levittown, east of New York City, but these suburbs exist in every metropolitan area of the country. It was a federal suburbanization program. At the time, and I know it's hard to believe this was so recent, but at the time, we were a manufacturing economy. Factories had to be located near deepwater ports and railroad terminals so that they could get their parts and ship their final products. So we were a manufacturing economy concentrated in downtown areas, and the workers in those factories, as well as the employees of banks and insurance companies and other firms that serviced the manufacturing sector, they all had to live in urban areas. They had to get to work. They didn't have, many of them didn't have cars. They took streetcars to get to work. They walked to their jobs. So the downtown areas at that time, and I'm talking about until the post-World War II period, until the 1950s even, were broadly biracial communities. I'm not suggesting that every other home was a different race that was fully integrated, but people lived in much greater proximity to people of other races than we do today. Well, the federal government, as I said, embarked on a program to move the whites out of those downtown biracial areas into single-family homes in the suburbs. I gave the example of Levittown, east of New York City. That was probably the most famous one. Many of your listeners probably have heard of it or read about it. 17,000 homes built in the late 1940s by William Levitt. An enormous project. Levitt was a bigot. He wouldn't have sold homes to African Americans on his own if given the choice. He couldn't get financing for the project. He went from bank to bank trying to get loans to buy the land and build the housing. Nobody would give him a loan. And the same thing is true on the West Coast and in the suburbs that were created in that period on the West Coast as well. The only way he could get financing for this project, this enormous project, was going to the Federal Housing Administration and Veterans Administrations, submitting his plans for the development, the architectural design, the layout of the streets, the building materials he's going to use, and a commitment never to sell a home to an African American that the federal government required. This was not the action of rogue bureaucrats. It was written out in a federal policy manual. The manual was distributed to appraisers all over the country, whose job it was to recommend or not recommend developers for loans, for loan guarantees to build suburbs. The manual said you couldn't recommend for a federal bank guarantee, a loan to a developer who is going to sell to African Americans. The manual went so far as to say that you couldn't even recommend for a federal bank guarantee a loan to a developer of an all-white project if it was going to be located near where African-Americans were living.
Wow.
Because in the words of the manual, that would run the risk of infiltration by inharmonious racial groups. So this is how the suburbs of this country, the white suburbs in this country, were created. But let me just take one more minute and explain why this underlies all of the other problems that you began by describing.
Yeah.
The white families, and these were returning war veterans, these were working class families, lower middle class families. The white families who moved to these suburbs did not expect to get rich by moving to these places. These were very inexpensive homes. They cost about $9,000. Levittown, about $8,000. In today's money, it's a little bit more than $100,000, inflation adjusted. They were modest homes. The families who moved there needed a place to live. We had an enormous housing shortage at the time. They were living in cities. The returning war veterans doubled up, tripled up with relatives, not able to find adequate housing. They were desperate for housing. The federal government provided this housing. But unexpectedly, they did get rich from this subsidized program, because over the next couple of generations, in a completely unanticipated event, those homes appreciated in value enormously. They don't no longer sell them, not on the West Coast, not anywhere else in the country, for $100,000. You can't buy a suburban home for $100,000.
Sure.
Anywhere.
Yeah.
$200,000, $300,000, $400,000, $500,000. You're on the West Coast in some of our more expensive cities, $1 million or more. Same homes.
Yeah. Right.
White families who bought those homes gained wealth from the appreciation, unexpected, of their properties. They used the wealth to send their children to college. They used it to perhaps take care of temporary unemployment or medical emergencies. They used it to subsidize their retirements. And they used it to bequeath wealth to their children and grandchildren, who then had down payments for their own homes. African Americans were prohibited from participating in this wealth-generating program. The result is that today, on average, African-American incomes are about 60% of white incomes. There's a disparity there. There's another story behind that. But you'd think that if they had 60% on average of the incomes of white households, they would have 60% of the wealth as well. People can save the same amount of money from the same incomes. But
sure,
in reality, while African-American families have 60% of the incomes on average of white families, African-American households have 5% or less of the wealth that white families have. And that's what underlies all the problems that you're describing. They're locked into those neighborhoods because they can't afford to move out of them. Levittown, for example.
Yeah.
In 1968, we passed the Fair Housing Act. The Fair Housing Act said, in effect, okay, black people, you can now move to Levittown. Nobody's going to stop you. It's no longer prohibited. But Levittown's unaffordable to these families who could have, whose parents and grandparents could have afforded to move there had they been permitted to do so and gained the same wealth that whites. The result is, you know, there are some African Americans who can afford homes for $500,000, which is about what homes in Levittown sell for today. A few, Levittown is about 2% African American today as a result of the Fair Housing Act. But Levittown's in a neighborhood that is about 13% African-American.
Yeah.
And so that difference between the 2% that we have as a result of the Fair Housing Act and the 13% that we have from the failure to remedy the unconstitutional and unlawful policies that the federal government enacted in the 20th century is the cause of much of the inequality that we have today in health, in education, in jobs, employment.
Yeah. I mean, environmental too. And I guess that's part of why I opened this with zoning. When you talk about sort of the intentional segregation there, part of what I think I understood was that even prior to World War II, there was a desire to separate the races, but that was considered unlawful at the time. And so they said, well, if we say single family houses are here, and we sort of subsidize all the white families to move to those single family houses, because you couldn't, if you just said no single families and apartments have to be separate, there were still a lot of poor whites living in apartment buildings as well. So the idea was get them out of those apartments and into single family homes. Is that part of it?
I'd say a little more complicated than that. The zoning is under the purview of local governments, state and local governments, mostly local.
Yep.
The federal government has nothing to do with zoning policy.
That's true. Yep.
So prior to the Depression and the New Deal and the Roosevelt administration, there were many local governments that imposed zoning rules, some racially explicit, as you said. You know, I began working on this back around the time of the Ferguson events. And the St. Louis area had very racially explicit zoning programs that required African Americans to live in neighborhoods with industrial facilities that were polluted, prevented those kinds of commercial operations from locating in white neighborhoods. But this was all local. Then, as you noted, the Supreme Court prohibited a zoning policy that was enacted in some of the border states, Baltimore, Louisville, in which they prohibited white families from moving on to majority black blocks and black families from moving on to majority white blocks. To me, the most interesting thing about those ordinances that those cities adopted in the early 20th century is it indicated how integrated those urban areas were at the time.
Sure.
You had whites moving into black blocks and blacks moving into white blocks, and this is what the ordinances were designed to prohibit. They wouldn't have been necessary if we were a segregated society at that time. Well, the Supreme Court said that specifically those kinds of ordinances could not be maintained. They prevented property owners from disposing of their property as they saw fit. And so what cities and counties did after that, as you said, is they adopted zoning laws that were race neutral on their face, but that were designed to preserve middle class, upper class communities as free of multi-unit housing units as possible. Those zoning laws, although they're racially neutral on their face, is what has perpetuated the segregation that was created previously and then after World War II, as I mentioned, by unconstitutional public policy.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting to me just that dichotomy, too, of like the Supreme Court says you can't have these policies explicitly separating the races, right? And so they come up with zoning and things as these kind of workarounds. But then the FHA comes out post-war and says, okay, if you want to get a federally guaranteed loan, you have to abide by certain policies, one of which being you will never sell to a black person or a person of color. Like, what allowed that change to happen? Why was it so explicit all of a sudden, you know, post-40s, but in the 20s and 30s, it had been, you know, we have to find workarounds. We have to find other ways to say this without saying it.
Well, it wasn't a change. As I mentioned, the federal government was not involved in housing policy at all prior to the deal. So when the federal government got involved, the FHA and the VA later, the FHA in the 1930s and the VA in the 1940s, had this racially explicit program. But it's not that the federal government ever supported non-segregated housing prior to that.
They're
involved in housing at all. I mentioned the subsidies that created the suburbs, whites only. Public housing is another program that began for the first time in the New Deal. We never had any civilian public housing before the 1930s. The federal government, not local housing agencies, created the first public housing in the early 1930s as part of a New Deal recovery program. And everywhere the federal government created public housing, it segregated it, creating separate projects for whites, separate projects for African Americans, frequently segregating neighborhoods that, as I indicated before, may not have been segregated previously. In my book, The Color of Law, I describe the great African-American poet, novelist, playwright, Langston Hughes, who describes in his autobiography how he grew up in an integrated downtown Cleveland neighborhood. He said he went to high school, and his best friend there was Polish. He dated a Jewish girl in high school. It was an integrated high school in an integrated neighborhood.
Yeah.
The federal government went into that neighborhood, demolished housing, and built two separate projects, one for whites, one for African Americans, creating a pattern of segregation in Cleveland that hadn't previously existed And then with other public housing projects segregated elsewhere in the Cleveland metropolitan area, reinforced that pattern of segregation. So the federal government, from its first involvement in housing, followed a policy of segregation, blatantly unconstitutional and blatantly unlawful.
Yeah.
We've never remedied it, and that's why it's necessary to begin to remedy it now. You know, I wrote this book, The Color of Law, and gave, you know, lots of interviews like this, and people read the book, and they all came and asked me, well, what can we do about it now?
Yeah.
And that's why I recruited my daughter, Aaliyah Rothstein. She's a housing expert. I was a historian. I knew the history. She knew the housing. So I recruited her to help me write a sequel to The Color of Law about what we do about it now. And there's something very interesting in the way we approach this topic. Although the patterns of segregation that exist today around the country were created by unconstitutional federal policy, once these patterns are created, it's local programs and practices that reinforce and sustain it and exacerbate it. We have a lot of opportunities at the local level to take action to redress segregation that would make a significant dent in the patterns of segregation that we have, even though those policies were enacted to create the segregation at the federal level. There is no political will at the federal level now,
sure,
to reduce segregation. But there are lots of opportunities for local activists to engage and take action that would make a significant difference. And the thing that gave us hope and why we wrote the book is that 20 million Americans participated in Black Lives Matter demonstrations in 2020.
Yeah.
And they weren't just African-American. No, they were whites and blacks. They were suburban and urban. There were many, many of these demonstrations in all white suburbs. They were low-income, middle-class people, other ethnicities. 20 million Americans, the biggest outpouring for racial justice in this country's history. But then the demonstrators went home. Many of them put Black Lives Matter signs on their lawns or in their windows and did nothing further. And we think that one of the reasons that they did nothing further is that nobody told them what they could do. Nobody explained what could be done. But nobody asked him to do anything.
Yeah.
And that's why we wrote this new book, which is entirely focused on what can be done in local communities, irrespective of what the federal government does, that would make a significant dent in residential segregation. And that, in turn, will affect all of those other problems that stem from segregation that we began by discussing.
Yeah. I mean, it really all stems out from this issue of housing, as we've been talking about, just medical issues and wealth, environmental, like everything ties back to housing and having secure housing and having the wealth accumulation that comes from owning housing. But it is still a huge, I mean, you talk about like Black Lives Matter and stuff. I'm here in the Boston area, very liberal part of the country, very rural, not far from the city either. And I remember, you know, driving around a lot of these very wealthy rural suburbs, 2020, 2021, seeing Black Lives Matter signs everywhere and thinking, yes, but where are the black residents? Where's the housing? You know, like, and I got to say too, I guess Just Action helped me question some of those assumptions that there's a need for housing for everybody, but that all of these barriers over the last 100+ years have contributed to very segregated neighborhoods racially, even if people might be in the same boat economically.
Yes, you're absolutely right about that. You know, there are many people who are today trying to accommodate themselves to a rogue Supreme Court that says that we should let bygones be bygones and not worry about remedying any of the unconstitutional policies of the past. And so they say, well, we should just try to enact programs that benefit poor people or lower income people and not worry about race, and that will help African Americans as well.
Yeah,
it's a false notion. For example, low-income whites tend to live in more middle-class neighborhoods than low-income blacks, who tend to live in poor neighborhoods. Low-income whites are not segregated into separate neighborhoods. Their children go to schools that are better resourced because there aren't only poor children in those schools. They have access to better jobs. They neighborhoods they live in are not so polluted. They are not harassed by the police because they're not concentrating in large numbers. Many low-income whites are just episodically low-income. They may have lost a job for a while, and their incomes fall, and they're counted as low-income, and then they recover. African-American poverty, because they're locked into these segregated neighborhoods, it's more persistent. It's more permanent. It's not a temporary event. Middle-class African-Americans live in neighborhoods also that have higher poverty rates than middle-class whites do. So they don't have the same opportunities that middle-class whites have. One of the things, the phrases that we use in the book Just Action is that race-specific crimes require race-specific remedies. Hmm. And there's nowhere around it. And you can't comfort yourself by saying, oh, well, the Supreme Court said we can't acknowledge race, so we'll just use economics instead. It won't work. It won't deal with the problem. But there are many things that we can do in the suburbs that you drove around in, Boston area, in places like that all over the country, that are not federal again. They're not federal policy. There's local policies. And one of the things is, as you mentioned earlier, zoning reform. Zoning reform is a necessary step. It's not a sufficient step, but it's a necessary step to begin to address this segregation. What we need is not building high rises of poor people in affluent white neighborhoods. That's not what we need. What we need is permission to build duplexes, triplexes in single family home neighborhoods so that more affordable, that blend in with the neighborhood, and they don't change the character of the neighborhood. That's a nonsense idea that somehow allowing middle class people into affluent neighborhoods or even working class people into affluent neighborhoods is going to change the character of the neighborhood. It won't. There are many neighborhoods in this country built earlier in the century, in the 20th century, that you can't tell whether a house, if you walk by without going up to the porch and looking at how many mailboxes it has, whether it's a duplex or a single family home.
Yeah.
These kinds of architectural designs blend very well into single family home neighborhoods, but they could open up the opportunity for middle-class African-Americans, working-class African-Americans, to move to neighborhoods that are better resourced, where they have access to fresh food that's sold by grocery stores that they don't have in segregated low-income neighborhoods, healthier food, where they have access to cleaner air and better resourced schools and all the rest. And so it's just a myth that somehow that if we abolish single-family zoning, all we're going to get is a segregated black building is in the and poor in the midst of segregated white neighborhoods.
Yeah.
It's not the way it has to work.
I mean, it's interesting, too. You touched on there just sort of integrated neighborhoods and what they look like historically. And I think about that relative to like where people like to travel in this country, right? That like when you're in New York City, people love to walk through Greenwich Village and see all the townhouses and the sidewalk cafes or, you know, here in Boston, the Back Bay. Like people aren't booking vacations generally to Levittown or to Orange County, California, or, you know, like there are places that are white single family developments that are just not pleasant to be in. And I was stuck in traffic the other day in the middle of reading your book and looking at my GPS, and I could see little icons for accidents just all around me. There were maybe 5-6 accidents within 2 or 3 miles of me right at rush hour. And it just hit me like, wow, the reason commuting sucks is because of racism and zoning and segregation. Like if we built more neighborhoods now or for the last 100 years, like we did at the turn of the 20th century, neighborhoods would have character and I might be able to walk to work or take a trolley to work or certainly walk to a sidewalk cafe. But like quality of life because of segregation, it hurts all of us, I guess. Like a quote unquote nice white neighborhood, you still need to drive to do anything. You're stuck in a sea of grass and not much else.
Well, there are certainly environmental reasons to increase density in every neighborhood.
Yeah.
Part of, obviously, a big program about fighting climate change is to increase the density of where people live so that there's, as you say, less commuting. But, you know, we do have a situation in this country, kind of cultural change, where young people in particular want to move to urban neighborhoods of the kind that you describe. And in many places, this is leading to what we call gentrification.
Sure.
Neighborhoods that used to be segregated all black or Hispanic, depending on the part of the country, become open to middle-class tech workers or people in other professional fields who want to live in a walkable urban neighborhood. One of the things we talk about in the book Just Action is the importance of, you can't stop that. You can't and you shouldn't stop it. It does create the possibility of desegregation of those neighborhoods and improvement in the quality. But what you can do is enact a number of policies. Again, these are local. They're not federal. You can enact a number of policies. And I'm not saying they're not being done anywhere. They're being done small ways. Enact policies that prevent the massive displacement of the existing residents. And we talk about a number of them. One of them, and this is not, these are not new ideas, and many things we talk about in Just Action that are being done in small ways in some places and need to be done in bigger ways in more places. One of them is inclusionary zoning, requiring developers who build market rate housing in some of these rapidly improving neighborhoods to set aside a share of units, not just for poor people, but for working class families. So people who have previously lived in those neighborhoods can remain. Another that we talk about in Just Action is creation of land trusts, which again, there are some 200 of them around the country. They're too small and they need to be a lot more of them. But a land trust is typically a nonprofit organization to which public authorities donate land, sometimes from abandoned properties, sometimes from foreclosed properties, sometimes because public authorities have a lot of land use land, schools that no longer have sufficient number of pupils, so it's empty land. The public authorities donate land to the land trust, or a private foundation buys land and donates it to a land trust. The land trust then constructs homes, single family duplexes, triplexes, or for sale or others for rental on this land that's been donated to them. And they sell them at affordable rates to lower and moderate income families. They can do that because what they do is they keep ownership of the land. So they're only selling the houses on top of the land. And as you know, the biggest cause of price inflation of housing in this country is the escalating cost of land. Underneath it, it's not that it costs that much more to build a house in a multi-million-dollar neighborhood than it does in a low-income neighborhood. It does cost a little bit more, but not that much more. The big difference is the cost of land. Yeah. And so the land trust sells homes to moderate-income families in these gentrifying neighborhoods that are affordable. And when the owners of those homes or the renters leave, but for example, the owners of those homes decide to sell, they too can only sell the house. They can't sell the land underneath. The price is typically restricted so that the sellers, the people who are selling the homes, have gained some equity, but not the kind of equity that you would gain from owning the escalating price of the land underneath. So this is something that can be done, you know, everywhere in the gentrifying neighborhoods to preserve affordable housing. And there are many other policies as well we talk about. So you're right, there is a growing interest in these urban neighborhoods on the part of white professionals. And this is a healthy development in the sense that those neighborhoods will improve, but they have to improve for the existing residents as well as for the new residents. The kinds of policies I just described are some of the ways that you can do that.
Yeah. I mean, that is a tough balance between keeping neighborhood character and worrying about displacement, but also allowing for integration, which, you know, can lead to gentrification, certainly. I wanted to back up too and just talk a little bit about your journey as an author around this content, going back to, you know, prior to The Color of Law, even. I mean, I've read both your books now and I'm still clearly through this conversation coming to terms with the details and understanding the details myself. And as we've kind of discussed here, they aren't always right at the surface, even though they are fairly recent history. What was it that first made you want to research this topic? And talk to me too about just the research process of uncovering these laws, uncovering these deed restrictions, things like that.
Well, I spent much of my prior career as an education policy writer.
Okay.
I was the education columnist, the weekly columnist at the New York Times for a while, journalist. I wrote about education policy for a think tank in Washington, D.C., the Economic Policy Institute. That was what I was concerned with, that what I was writing about. And as I wrote more and more about education, I began to understand that the reason we have such an enormous achievement gap between Black and white children is not because of the quality of schools that Black children attend, but it's primarily because of the social and economic disadvantages that they come to school with that prevent them from taking advantage of even what a great school can offer. And I wrote many columns along these lines. I remember one that I wrote, we're talking now 20 years ago, more than that, 25 years ago. I remember one column I wrote about asthma. African-American children in the urban neighborhoods have asthma at four times the rate in many urban neighborhoods than middle-class children living in the suburbs. Four times the rate, wow. So enormous difference.
Yeah.
They have asthma at such a higher rate because they live in more polluted neighborhoods, more trucks driving by their homes, more vacant lots kicking up dust, more vermin in the environment, more deteriorating buildings. And if a child has asthma, which are always talking about averages, it's not true in every case, but if a child has asthma, that child is more likely, not in every case, but more likely than a child who doesn't have asthma to be up at night wheezing. And coming to school drowsy the next day. And if a child, and again, this is not true in every case, but we're talking about averages. If a child is drowsy in school, they're going to do less well in school.
Yeah.
No matter how good the instruction is. And this doesn't make a big impact on the achievement gap between Black and white children, a small one, but then you begin to think of all of the others that make this kind of impact. The lead poisoning, much more prevalent in low-income neighborhoods than in white suburban. Lack of access to primary care, health care. I remember a bunch of people once made fun of me because I wrote about disparities in dental care. Very few dentists in many of these neighborhoods. And children who come to school with toothaches are going to be less attentive.
Yeah.
People ridiculed me for having the toothache theory of the achievement gap. But it's just one of many, many of these kinds of things.
Yeah. You start adding all those little pieces and it becomes a really big,
That's exactly right. So I gradually realized, and it took me a while, but I gradually realized that if you concentrate children with one or more of these disadvantages in single schools, the notion that if only teachers try harder, they can get middle-class outcomes was silly. And so I began to worry about a neighborhood concentration of segregated schools. I decided the segregated schools were the biggest problem facing public education. And then I realized, you may think I'm stupid taking so long to figure this out. And maybe I was. But I realized that the schools are segregated because the neighborhoods in which they're located are segregated. So I began to realize that neighborhood segregation was a school problem. I still wasn't thinking that much about the residential segregation in itself. But then I realized a few other things as I began to think about this. This is on video, right?
Yeah, sure.
Okay, so people can see I'm an old man. In 1965, I was a research assistant at the Chicago Urban League. And one of the projects that I worked on in that and a few years after that was a lawsuit that civil rights lawyers were pursuing in the city of Chicago against the Chicago Housing Authority and city council for the fact that the Housing Authority and city council were placing public housing projects for Black households in Black neighborhoods and public housing projects for white households in white neighborhoods. Like I said, I was a young man at that time. I was in my early 20s. I worked on this lawsuit. I was not a thinker about it. I was following instructions, but I remembered this. That lawsuit, by the way, led to the end of public housing in this country. It was an overreaction, and was called the Gautreau suit, G-A-U-T-R-E-A-U-X, went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court upheld a lower court decision that required the Chicago City Council and Housing Authority to stop segregating its public housing. This was in the 1960s. You're talking about recent history.
Sure.
So as I began to think about this in the early 2000s, I remembered doing this work, and I realized that, you know, the de facto segregation myth may not be all there is to it, because clearly this was a public policy that was creating segregation in the city of Chicago.
Right.
And that's partly how I came to it. Also in the 1960s, I was involved as a young person in the civil rights movement and, you know, remembered many of the things that I had learned at that time. So all these things came together. That's how I came to do this work and to shift my focus from education policy to the history of residential segregation. But although I did some, and this is the second part of your question, how I did the research, I did some original research, I did some archival work, but mostly the subtitle, The Color of Law, the subtitle of that book was A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America. And mostly I was able to use published sources that had never been made accessible to a general public. They were academic sources. But there are a number of great books written about this. One was written in 1948 by Robert Weaver, who later became the first African-American cabinet member in this country. He was the first Secretary of Housing and Urban Development in the 1960s. In 1948, he wrote a book describing all of the policies that I described that the New Deal had been following up to that point to create segregation. Nothing new in what I did. And there were some other more recent books that maybe students in college courses sometimes read. A book by Massey and Denton called American Apartheid, I think, or Apartheid in America, one of those titles. One book about the making of the second ghetto in Chicago. A book about the suburbanization that I described by historian Kenneth Jackson. These are all academic books. So mostly what I did was just bring to a general audience information that was there for anybody who wanted to look at it in academic sources.
But as you say, hidden, not well known, but there. Real quick, just kind of wrapping it up now, you've got this new book out and you mentioned it was co-authored with your daughter, Leah. I'm curious about just working with her and how that process has been and sort of what you each bring to the table.
It's the best thing that ever happened to me.
Yeah,
I realized that I couldn't answer the question people were asking me, what can we do about this, without much more knowledge than I had about housing policy. I knew the history. I also had a journalistic background. I was so that I knew how to write for a general audience.
Yeah.
What Leah brought to the project was a good knowledge about housing policy, contemporary housing policy. She had worked in the affordable housing industry. She had worked in public agencies. She knew how all this stuff worked to the extent that I didn't. I was learning a lot from doing it. So when I realized I had to answer this question, I realized I needed a partner who could provide the background that I didn't have. I was fortunate in having one nearby. So I persuaded her to quit her job. She was working for public agencies at the time and devote full time to co-authoring this book with me.
Wow.
It was a wonderful experience for me, and I think she appreciated it as well. It was a father's dream, really, to do this. And she's now going around the country giving lectures and talks to different groups who want to know more about what they can do in their own local communities to redress segregation.
Yeah. I mean, let's end it there, I guess, with just the question of the action piece of this, whether it's The Color of Law or Just Action. Like, people are going to read your work and I think get stirred up and want to get involved in some way. Where would you guide people to start? What do you think is the first step that people should be taking beyond just education?
Well, Just Action discusses dozens of dozens and more, a dozen and more policies, many policies, scores of policies, let's say, programs at a local level that people can enact. And one of the things we say, it doesn't matter where you start. the important thing is to start somewhere. And small victories will lead to larger ones, and eventually, hopefully, your communities will become more desegregated than they are now. But it really doesn't matter where you start. There are so many opportunities for local action. Some, I know we don't have time to go into much more of it, but some of them take very little effort. Some of them take much more effort. People can volunteer, for example, to engage in testing programs that fair housing centers conduct, in which matched testers go to real estate agents and landlords, as matched in the sense of African-Americans and whites with identical qualifications, and see if they're treated differently.
Yeah,
that kind of volunteer work is easy to do. To bigger projects, all local, one of the things we write about in Just Action is how the property assessment system, communities all over the country, is discriminatory. African-Americans pay, who own homes, pay property taxes at a higher rate than whites do. Discriminatory system, assessors recognize it. It's not a mystery. There's no mystery about the discriminatory nature of the system. But without public pressure, it's not going to be fixed. It's this, and as a result, African-Americans are being extorted for a bigger share, a bigger burden of paying for schools and libraries and fire departments than whites are. This is, again, the federal government has nothing to do with local tax assessment policies. The segregation of the neighborhoods was created by the federal government, but the differences in assessment policies in those neighborhoods had the federal government has nothing to do with. So this is so on the one hand, you have something very simple, like just volunteering to be a tester. On the other hand, a campaign at a local level that takes much more organization and effort to end the discriminatory assessment system that reduces African-American wealth because they have to pay so much higher taxes than whites do. So the range of policies is enormous. It doesn't matter where you start. You mentioned zoning reform. That's something that can be done. And many of these things are being done at different places.
Yeah.
They need to be expanded. They need to be deepened. They need to become more widespread.
All right. Richard Rothstein there. A lot to dive into, a lot to think about. Clearly, I am still learning all this stuff, and there are so many layers to this. But again, if you read The Color of Law, it is broken down in very digestible, simple bites, and it's something that I think is hard to turn your back on. So go check out The Color of Law, A Forgotten History of How Our Government Segregated America by Richard Rothstein. And his new book as well, co-written with Leah Rothstein, is called Just Action, How to Challenge Segregation Enacted Under the Color of Law. And I said at the beginning, but I've got some other episodes that kind of tie into this. So go check out my recent conversation with Richard Frischman and B. Brian Foster, very much in the same vein as this conversation. And also Syra Rao is another good one to listen to. Go back, listen to that conversation. And I think for me, I'm realizing these are ongoing conversations. This is not a one and done thing. It's like the more pieces of this puzzle that you start putting together, the more that you see the big picture. And I like that everybody is bringing something different to this conversation. But when you listen to all of them, you start saying, oh, okay, I can see more clearly what's actually happening. And the thing that I was taught by my teachers, by the media, by whatever, is that really true? Or is there more examination that I need to do? And that's our job as citizens, right? To be engaged in democracy, to understand what's going on, and to really, really try to see every issue from other people's perspectives, because we can't just look at our own take on the world and think that's it. It's a whole big world out there. Listen to people, learn, come back for more conversations like that on this podcast. And again, check out my newsletter, heathrasella.com/newsletter. Every Sunday, every Wednesday, sign up, get on the list. And if you're able to, please become a paying member. It really helps support the work that I do here, heathrasella.com/newsletter. I am at Heath Rasella on social media. Please give me a follow over there. And please subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast app. Leave a nice rating, leave a nice review. It really helps people find it. I will talk to you in 2 weeks. Until then, stay safe.